various other elements of our comp plan. We talk about, you know, walkability, bikeability, placemaking. You know, that becomes kind of hippie trippy stuff to a lot of folks here in Taylor. But when you can talk dollars and cents and revenue per acre and what this does for the bottom line, that's when they sit up and take notes and say, you know, this really does make a lot of sense.
Helping community leaders grow financially resilient, resource conscious, and people friendly cities is the Go Cultivate podcast, brought to you by Verdunity.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of our Go Cultivate podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Shepherd, and I've got AJ Favre back on with me this morning. Good morning, AJ.
Hey, good morning.
So, man, it's been a while since since we did one of these together.
It has.
So, yeah, it's we did our first episode back. I interviewed Chuck, and we had introduced Marshall. A little bit, but like we talked about in that first one back, kind of our standard format for these new ones going forward is going to be you and I doing the intro to each episode, where we'll kind of share a little bit about the topic and why we think it's important, and then we'll come back at the end of the episode and talk about a few takeaways, and then we've also got you lined up to do some interviews in the next few months as well. So I know the podcast stuff is something we both enjoy doing, so it's good to be back. I'm excited to kind of dig into some of these issues more with you. So today we've got Tom Yantis and Brant Rydell from Taylor, Texas. Brant Rydell is the mayor. Tom is the assistant city manager, development services director. And we just recently finished a comprehensive plan with them. We were part of a team that worked on that. It's been about a year and a half now, I guess, since we started that. We'll talk here in a second just about you know, why I wanted to have them on and why I think their plan is somewhat unique. But why do you think, AJ, you know, I know we've had some past episodes where I think there was one where you and Jordan actually talked about, you know, are we doing this right related to comp plans? But as someone that's worked on the city side, and done a number of different plans, what do you think is important about a comprehensive plan for cities, and why do they need them?
Well, if you've heard that episode, you'll be familiar with me saying this. And if you haven't heard that episode, you should definitely go listen to it. You know, I think it's important to understand the direction a community is going to move in. You know, it's really hard as someone working on the city side to feel like you are fulfilled in your work and that you're really achieving all that you can when there really isn't a clear direction for the organization, and then the community is an extension of that. So that's really critical for your team at the city, regardless of the city size, to just understand the part that they play and be allowed to, within their talents and level of expertise, contribute to that overall cause in some way. So in that way, I think that that's really important. I think, you know, where a lot of these things go wrong, I won't go into the entire list, but some of the ones that we have mentioned before are, you know, coming into this effort ready to do a comprehensive plan, but really not thinking about or committing to the implementation of that plan. The actual putting together of the document, the engagement that goes into it, the finalization and adoption of the plan, you know, that's not where it ends. That's really where you take a quick breath and then you really have to hit the ground running with implementing that plan. Otherwise, you've just wasted a lot of money. You're going to hear that from your community because you're not going to have the buy-in that's necessary. And you end up being these communities that we hear from so often that have a really outdated comp plan, and they're really not making their decisions in accordance with it, which of course is the point of our local government code and the section on comprehensive planning, you know, in that state statute that we're all required, quote unquote, to follow. So I think this is a good interview for someone that's thinking about going into that process, because I think it covers the spectrum of the start to finish of the plan and then moving into the implementation and how you do that seamlessly. I think, you know, I'll reserve some comments later on in the podcast, but I think one of the things that you'll mention Tom talking about, or that you'll hear Tom talking about in this episode, is that they had a number of planning documents in Taylor that were all really out of date, and the order in which they had put those planning documents together didn't make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And that's something that every community has encountered at some point. So it's not novel. It's something we are all familiar with. We've all seen before. But, you know, the challenge, of course, is if we are all so familiar with these errors, why do we continue to make them?
Right. And the thing that I think is different about the Taylor plan is the fiscal analysis piece that we did, and how it was such an integral part of the process all the way through. AJ, you talk about implementation, and sometimes, you know, the plans get done and they don't get implemented. One of my personal frustrations is they don't get implemented on the back end because the resources aren't there. You know, they mm-hmm. propose a lot of things that a city doesn't have the resources to do. And at the same time, there's opportunities with land use and zoning and some development decisions that can have a really significant impact on a city's fiscal health and the places that they're building. So the comp plans for us is a way to have that community conversation about why do they not have enough money for infrastructure? Why are their streets, you know, why are they behind on fixing streets? Why do they not have the mix of housing that they need to be affordable and you know, provide for different types of interests and generations, what have you? So this was really one of the first comp plans I've been a part of that that had that resource conversation all the way through, and I would attribute that to Tom and the mayor. And at the end of it, I think, as you'll hear in the conversation, it did impact the way that they're approaching growth management going forward. So let's go ahead and get into the interview. This is a conversation I had with Mayor Brant Rydell and Assistant City Manager Tom Yantis about the comprehensive plan update in Taylor, Texas. Enjoy the conversation, and AJ and I'll be back after with a few final thoughts and takeaways. So Mayor Brant Rydell and Tom Yantis from the City of Taylor, welcome to our Go Cultivate podcast.
Well, thank you for having us. I'm really excited to be. I've been a fan of your podcast for some time, so it's a thrill to be participating.
Yeah, I've actually, Mayor, I've told that story of when we were getting ready to, or I guess when Tom, when you were presenting the contract for your comprehensive plan and we were there in Taylor, you had asked me to kind of introduce myself and Verdunity. And right when I got up there, Mayor, you're like, I listened to your podcast. It's you know, listen to it on our run. So that's been a fun experience for us of something that we started just as kind of a side thing for us to talk about what we're passionate about and to see how the podcast has grown and where all it's being listened to is pretty cool for us. But, you know, wanted to have you guys on to talk mostly about the comprehensive plan process that that we're wrapping up with you all now. But before we dig into that, just as a way to get our listeners oriented with you all and your community, can you guys maybe take us back 18 months, maybe 2 years, to when you were first starting the conversation about why you needed to update your comprehensive plan and what were some of the things that were important to you guys and your community as you were looking to do that?
Well, I'm going to defer to Tom in large part on this because I'd like to him to share his perspective, because I've been on the Taylor City Council now for almost 10 years, and I don't think I looked at the existing comprehensive plan at all during that time. Of course, I understood how it informed underlying policy, but I don't think I was alone in the on the council and not being that familiar with the comprehensive plan, and certainly had little to no appreciation for how outdated it was. The last time we had done a comprehensive plan was in 2004. So Tom joined the city of Taylor a few years ago. I'll let him speak to that, but he probably, as he came on board, had a bit of alarm on where we stood in that respect. So, Tom.
Well, I don't know if it was alarm necessarily, but, you know, I came to the city from another fast-growing city in Central Texas, and I could tell just by some of what I was hearing from people and some of the phone calls I was getting that Taylor was about to be the next town in Central Texas that really exploded in terms of growth pressures coming from Austin. And like the mayor said, we had really outdated planning documents. The comprehensive plan was very old, and all of our zoning and development regulations were even older than that. So, you know, when we started down this path, I don't know that we had any preconceived notions as to how we were going to do it. And certainly, I don't know that we had had a discussion about fiscal analysis being the cornerstone of it. But as we started talking more, the mayor and a couple of the council members had been to a Texas Municipal League conference where they had heard the Strong Towns presentation. And so that sort of became the basis upon which we said, let's focus our discussion around how do we make Taylor financially resilient long term. And that's when we wrote that into our RFQ for the comprehensive plan process. I had also previously worked with Joe Minicozzi from Urban 3 when I was in another community here in Central Texas. And so I knew the power of that message just from having been a part of it in that community. And so it was a fairly natural fit for me, but I had no idea how the community was going to react to it so positively. And we'll talk more about that, I'm sure, in the session mm-hmm. if you have more questions.
Well, I want to piggyback on that real quick that, you know, I grew up in Taylor, and for years and years, you know, the talk in Taylor has been that next wave of growth and development coming out of Austin is going to hit Taylor, and it's coming and it's coming. Anyway, and it never came. And so it's almost a bit like crying wolf as the council would, as we engage with the community, tell them how important it was to be very conscientious about how Taylor is going to grow and develop, because those growth pressures were at our doorstep. And again, it's a little bit like the boy cried wolf. They're like, yeah, we've heard this before, but it really was at a critical point. And we're very fortunate to have folks like Tom on board to help us through this process. And certainly very happy to have Virginity help with this as well as we crafted our comprehensive plan.
So Mayor, you said you've grown up in Taylor. You know, and we're talking about the growth, it was, you've been talking about it's coming to Taylor, but it hadn't quite come. And I mean, you guys have an awesome little main street downtown that's done really, really well and is starting to blossom and strengthen. And that was, you know, in addition to the fiscal information, I guess we'll talk through that. But that was another thing that came out from the feedback, is the community's really strong to desire to protect that. A lot of places say we want to protect our small town feel, but you guys really do have kind of that authentic small town environment that, I mean, when we were comparing Taylor to some of the other surrounding communities of a Georgetown or a Round Rock, or for those not familiar with Central Texas, some of the typical kind of fast growing suburban communities, as you would typically think of them, Taylor has been unique, still is unique. And I think the community came out loud and clear that they want to stay unique in that way. So, would you kind of say that was the biggest challenge in Taylor at the time that we started this, is how you knew people wanted to preserve that, but you also felt that growth pressure coming. Is that a fair way to kind of describe the place you were in when we started this process?
Absolutely. From 1880 to 1980, Taylor was the largest city in Williamson County. You mentioned a couple of our sister cities, Georgetown and Round Rock, which are probably, you know, more well known. But Taylor was a dominant force in the county there for 100 years. So there's a lot of wealth that was created in the early part of that period, you know, the early 1900s. And when Interstate 35 was developed towards the west, going through towns or very near towns like Georgetown and through Round Rock, you know, a lot of that economic vitality shifted to the west and kind of left Taylor I think, widely perceived as kind of a backwater. And so a lot of the growth that occurred, that suburban growth post-World War II, occurred up that I-35 corridor, while Taylor kind of sat off to the side with relatively modest, if any, growth, and in fact, decline in some points in the latter half of the 20th century. So while that was kind of a depressive effect on the city, what it served to do was preserve in amber that kind of original core of the city, where we didn't have the explosive growth and development of the as a suburban sprawl effect occurred right Austin. So we're left off to the side 35 miles northeast of Austin. And, you know, people really appreciated that. And it's one thing that really, I mean, they appreciate that feel. They didn't appreciate the fact that Taylor seemed to be left behind by its counterparts. Right. But now it was almost a gift to Taylor, because we did not experience that kind of sprawl effect that so many of our closer in neighbors to Austin did experience. We did retain that small town feel and character. That's one thing a lot of people who are moving to Taylor, they gravitate towards that, because this does feel different than the inner ring of suburbia around Austin. And so we know that those pressures are coming, and those pressures involve the sprawl effect and, okay, bigger, better, faster, you know, follow the same model that has been followed heretofore. And that's why it was so critical to get this comprehensive plan in place and the guiding principles around it that we can articulate and communicate to our community on why it is that this is a worthwhile endeavor to pursue a different mindset when it comes to growth and development for Taylor to preserve what we have.
Well, yeah, you just touched on guiding principles and that information that you as elected officials can use to kind of, you know, frame the conversation in the community, that staff can use in terms of interpreting and administering the plan. So it's kind of my second part to this question before we get into some of the specifics is there's some folks out there that work in the planning field, that work in the development field that will say, and even a lot of our Strong Towns friends that will say, why mess with a comp plan? Go straight to the zoning codes and the development regulations and, you know, incremental development strategies that actually get stuff done right now. I think, Mayor, you touched on part of it with what you just said about guiding principles. But why, maybe Tom, a question for you as somebody that's done a lot of work with plans and codes, why did you feel so strongly that updating the comprehensive plan was a worthwhile endeavor for Taylor? And then how do you feel like that sets the stage for the code and the other implementation pieces that will come next?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kevin. And I will tell you that, you know, over my career, I've done it the opposite direction in multiple jurisdictions. And I don't think that it's healthy to start with coding before you get the community on the same page as to what they want. I think that all of us in the planning field know what the tools are that we need to have in place to get the types of places that we want. The challenge with going straight into that process before you've had the community come together is that when the results of that start getting built on the ground, and some people in the community may not like it, you don't have anything to fall back on to say, hey, we had this conversation together as a community, and this is the direction that we decided to go in. So I think that having that community dialogue as a part of the comprehensive plan process is critically important to get everybody onto the same page, especially in a town that hadn't done it for so many years. I mean, it had been, you know, 16 years since the last time the community had come together to have a conversation about what it wanted to be when it grew up. And, you know, if you don't have that basis to start the process, I think you end up in some conflicts down the road that you could have avoided. So I think that it is sometimes exhausting, and I understand why communities don't want to do it, because it takes a lot of time. It's hard. You have to have a lot of difficult conversations, but I think they're really worthwhile. I think one of the downsides that happens in some communities too is that you wear everybody out during the comprehensive plan process, and then you don't have any energy or financial resources left to do the next steps, which are really even just as important, which is to fix the rules. And so a lot of communities sort of fizzle out after they get the comp plan done. And I'm hoping that that's not the case here.
Well, I think one of the things that made you all different, in my opinion, was that you were willing to have the difficult conversations as part of the comp plan, right? A lot of times the comp plan, and this is a big part of why we stayed away from comp plans for a long time, was just it's really easy to say we want to do the visioning and we want to dream about what we want our city to be. But as soon as you put constraints on it, it's a different conversation, whether that's constraints about what resources do we have or where are we going to develop and what's going to go here. So, you know, that's part of what we look for when we pursue these projects, is what communities have the leadership that is ready to have these hard conversations that we're so passionate about that need to be happening. And it's why the main reason I was really excited to get you guys on here is you guys both, for different reasons, I think came to appreciate the value of the fiscal analysis and making that I use the phrase the common language, right? That can bring different perspectives together. Because you know, if you just talk land use, if you just talk zoning, if you talk about road diets, that kind of technical stuff will go over most people's heads. But when you make it about the value that they're getting from their home, from their property taxes, the ability to provide more services for the same revenue, or to generate more revenue to cover things that they feel aren't being funded properly, you see much, much stronger engagement. So why, Tom, did you feel like, you know, when you guys did the selection process, when you put your request for qualifications out, you had some pretty strong language in there that you wanted fiscal or financial resilience and sustainability to be a key principle and a key tenet of the plan. Why did you feel so strongly about making that part of the selection process? And then the second part of that would be, obviously you guys selected Lionheart and Verdunity together to work on this with you. What did you see with our team that made you comfortable that we were the right partners, I guess, to help facilitate this tricky conversation in your community?
Well, I think that for the city of Taylor, the community itself had already had an experience of what Strong Towns talks about, that boom and bust of the growth Ponzi scheme. You know, so as the mayor alluded to, we had a huge growth spurt and a lot of wealth was created in the community 100 years ago. And then when all that growth slowed down to basically a crawl, there weren't the resources that the community needed to be able to invest in maintenance and the replacement of infrastructure. And that is very apparent when you come to Taylor. We have poor conditioned streets. We have a lot of challenges with our water and sewer infrastructure. And so I think having that experience as a community made it so easy for us to latch on to the concept that as we grow in this next iteration of our boom time, we have to do it in a way that we're not going to end up in the same boat again. So I think that was the underlying reason that the community had already identified that we've got to figure out a better way to finance our long-term maintenance obligations for our infrastructure. And the way that we've been growing, even though Taylor historically has grown pretty compactly and incrementally over time, mm-hmm. even that didn't provide enough revenue for right. us to maintain our infrastructure. And so, you know, it's hard to imagine all of these suburban communities right now that are sprawling out what the reckoning is going to be like for them in 100 years. And so, you know, we've had
some of those conversations, Tom.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and the fact that as a pretty compact, developed city, that Taylor has already experienced that, it's hard to imagine, you know, how much worse it's going to be for other communities, I think, in the future. And so I think that was the reason why we made it such a cornerstone of our planning process was that the community was already on the same page that we had to be able to finance these infrastructure maintenance obligations long term. And then you asked about y'all's specific team, and I'll just say that I think y'all's I asked for a strange arrangement between two consulting firms, right, that presented on our plan.
Yep.
And y'all were willing to do it because I saw the value that your team was going to bring to the fiscal analysis piece of the plan that no other team provided in the interview process. And then I saw the value that Lionheart's group had brought mm-hmm. to its understanding of Taylor through having done some other planning work for us. And so I think that, you know, asking y'all to work together, I think was the right solution for us. And hopefully it wasn't too painful for you.
No, and we had I appreciate that. Yeah. I mean, we submitted on our own for it. And then, you gave me the phone call and said, hey, would you be willing to talk about this? And we did. And I think, Rebecca and her team have been fun to work with. And I think it's one of the better experiences, frankly, that we've had in some of these forced marriages that we get asked to do sometimes. But there's still, every one of these that we do, we learn some things from you and from Rebecca of how some of this information was shared and used incorporated into the process. And then there's still always that part of us that feels like, well, if we were just driving this completely ourselves, we might have made this decision a little faster or been able to communicate this a little bit better or differently or whatever. But by and large, this was a great process to be a part of. And I think the end result is one of the better comp plans I've been a part of. And I'm excited to see, you guys are still going through the adoption process right now, right? Or has it been?
Yeah, just in two more days, Thursday night, November the 18th is the date that we will be hopefully adopting the plan.
So we're recording this middle November. And so you guys are having your second and final discussion to adopt it. I'll come back to the adoption process here later with a couple of questions on that. And I see the mayor laughing. So your growth strategy in the plan, there's two parts with it. There's a growth management piece that I think is great. And then there's the future land use map, as you would expect to see. Your growth strategy prioritizes infill, prioritizes missing middle housing, prioritizes maximizing development around existing infrastructure, all through that lens of improving the fiscal health of the community, right? I mean, filling in those vacant lots, diversifying the housing so you get that revenue per acre bump that we talk about, but you're also getting affordable, affordable price points and mix of neighborhoods. You also have the mobility network, the gridded approach to the transportation plan as well that was part of this that is so critical to supporting these mixed use walkable neighborhoods. But as we were going through the process, when we started this, we were just talking about how Taylor was right on the verge of the push towards the horizontal expansion of we want the new greenfield, suburban detached single family neighborhoods out on the edge. You want the big box commercial. And so that you were just starting to trend that direction. And now we kind of had to unwind that and pull them back and focus them into the core. And so as part of that, you have people that either like that, the way things were trending, or you have folks that own property in those peripheral parts of the community. What did you say to those folks through the process?
Mayor, you want to start with that one or you want me to?
Well, I'll say with the more recent developments we've had in Taylor, and those have just been in the last few years, and I'm not sure how much those had to do with the growth and development pressures coming out of Austin. There's certainly an aspect of it, but there's actually a bit of courting and convincing these developments to come to Taylor because there have just been no activity or traction whatsoever for so long. I think, I don't know if desperation is the right term, but people wanted to see something. Although, you know, with those developments, and which are I think arguably are more along the lines of the horizontal kind of sprawl suburban mm-hmm. effect, I can tell you that I've gotten feedback from the community along those lines that they had some concerns and issues about that, and it was not the kind of development they were wanting to see in Taylor. And I think with each, and Tom can speak to this because we have these conversations, was with each successive development that is coming through to Taylor, incrementally, we're refining the mix, the development that is more in line with this fiscal sustainability approach. Frankly, we're caught a little flat-footed, again, with these more recent developments. I think we did have just a mindset as a leadership in Taylor that we just wanted to see something happen. And if it was going to be the more traditional out-of-the-box development, then we were just happy to get something. Mm-hmm. We have certainly gotten an education in recent years. And I'll go back to what Tom alluded to a little while ago. That Texas Municipal League conference up in Fort Worth that I attended a few years ago, which was the first time I was exposed to Chuck Marone and Strong Towns, that was like the veil was lifted at that point. After a couple of sessions, I went to, and some of our other councilmates were there as well. And it really fundamentally changed my thinking on growth and development and what would be healthy for the community. But with that, I'll turn it over to Tom.
Yeah, you know, Kevin, I think that Taylor was on the same path that most suburban mm-hmm. communities, or just most communities in general, have been on for the last 75 years, which is that growth is good, expansion is natural and inevitable. And so when we started having the conversations about what were the most financially productive places in our town, and we found that they were all things that had been developed before the turn of the century, it was kind of eye-opening to everybody. The turn of the 20th century.
Yeah.
So, so it was eye-opening to people to say, oh, wow, you know, we haven't built anything that's as financially productive for the community in 150 years as those places that are in the core of the town now. And so then, you know, I think you guys in your fiscal analysis approach where it's just so cut and dried, you know, it's like, all right, look at the six blocks of downtown and compare that to Walmart. And it's just natural to say a town has finite land resources. And we need to think about that like a farmer thinks of his farm and maximize the yields that we're going to get out of that finite amount of land that we have, because we've got to be able to be self-sustaining in perpetuity once we've filled up all of that land. And it's really hard to go back and undo a lot of bad choices that you make in the interim. So,
well, just to build on that, I mean, we did do, you know, we showed, like you mentioned, the six box downtown versus the Walmart. We showed, I think your top 18 or 19 parcels in the whole city, in terms of just value per acre, but also in net revenue after we load service costs in, we're all in that core area. I think something that we get into with some other places is helping them understand the costs that are coming with that, you know, and your ability to mitigate those costs, to fund those future costs. That's where if you have land left to develop, if you're not fully built out, this is the time to shift the pattern so that you can, close your gap as opposed to making it bigger and you know, the illusion of wealth that Chuck speaks to. Of it's very easy to get on that growth curve and say we're going to go get more growth, and it keeps bringing in revenue in the short term. And Mayor, you guys on council can say, look at all what we're doing and look at all of this growth, and hey, we can lower the tax rate. And that's all fine and dandy until you can't do that anymore. And
that's right.
You know, part of what I think what's different now than maybe definitely 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, is now we're starting to have some places here in Texas that we can point to that are breaking. And so we can start to show some of those places and how they're struggling fiscally and with infrastructure maintenance. Because early in the early days of Redunity, it was like, you know, I could show examples from other places outside of Texas that I've worked and what I saw, but it's like, oh, we're Texas. That's not going to happen to us. But I think that being able to show that from either show that or also just people understanding or feeling how that is starting to happen in some of the communities around us here in Texas is helping to make the point as well. Tom, I wanted to piggyback on that a little bit. And you guys mentioned the presentation that Chuck did that, you know, first got you guys thinking about it. I think Mayor, I may have seen you at some of the TML and economic development conferences that I've presented on the last couple of years. Tom, you've been to a lot of different conferences and followed Chuck's work. I think something that was helpful on this one from my perspective is it wasn't just me or our team giving this message, but it was also the two of you that took this same language and could kind of put your own local kind of twist on it that was helpful as well. Is that, did you guys feel the same way there, that maybe kind of the 1-2 or the 1-2-3 punch was some of what got folks on board?
Well, I don't know how well received anything coming from the mayor. If Taylor has been in the community in the last year and a half, it's been a tough time to be a public servant and leader. But the message of fiscal sustainability really just carried the day. That when you go to folks and it's a bottom line dollars and cents issue, because you can talk about various other elements of our comp plan. We talk about, you know, walkability, bikeability, placemaking. You know, that becomes kind of hippy trippy stuff to a lot of folks here in Taylor. But when you can talk dollars and cents and revenue per acre and what this does for the bottom line, that's when they sit up and take notes and say, you know, this really does make a lot of sense. And you know, and it makes sense to everybody. We might get into this a little bit later, but you know, here within the last week or so, I had several conversations with developers, real estate brokers, you name it, who are you know, now becoming aware of our comprehensive plan, the approach that Taylor's taking. And I talked to them about this fiscal sustainability model and what we're looking, you know, and how our growth and development is really the underpinning is on fiscal sustainability. And they all say, that makes perfect sense. I mean, that we get it. They don't like it. But I get that part too. But I mean, it's just, it makes logical sense to anybody who just pays attention to this and takes the time. And really that's really has carried the day here in Taylor, which I think is not dissimilar to any other community, that when you do that, fiscal analysis, it's very black and white.
So as we're working through this process, there were two growth scenarios that were looked at. One was kind of just continuing the current trend or looking at, you know, continuing some of the greenfield expansion. The second scenario was what was called the fiscal trend or the fiscal scenario, which was heavy on infill and maximizing existing infrastructure. And you guys had I won't call it the most robust engagement process I've ever been a part of, but it was very intentional. I think the steps that you guys took and when you did the workshops. And
during COVID, by the way.
Yeah, during COVID, we did. This whole process was like, oh yeah, here's COVID. let's do these remotely. And then towards the end, back in person. But I could, from my perspective, I could feel the conversation shifting. Like as we got further through the process of, you know, early on, it was education heavy about what does this all mean, and bringing Chuck, you know, you had Chuck do a presentation to the community. You had, you know, me do a couple that focused on, you know, focused on the modeling in your scenario. And then it, it did ultimately, right there in the middle of the process, it got to really the decision point, right, for the community of, all right, here it is. This is all what we're doing. Here's our two options. Are we going in on this fiscal scenario or not? And it was something like 80% of the people who responded to surveys supported the fiscal scenario. And that's always what I've seen. I haven't seen it quite to that extreme in some other places, but this information does work in getting more people that are maybe anti-density or anti-apartments or fill in the blank. It's pretty powerful in getting some of those folks that maybe might fight some of these things initially, getting them on board. You're always going to have that group of people that are going to be against it no matter what. But can you guys speak to, and maybe Tom, start with you, can you speak to the engagement process and some of the steps that you took to just bring elected officials, bring your planning commission, bring the advisory committee, and then the community at large? You were very intentional with just how you brought them through this process and what it meant, from a big picture education standpoint, to ultimately making a commitment towards a growth management plan and a land use plan that now you're going to stick to, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, that's the one advantage of aging, is that you get to learn from your mistakes and do things differently in over the course of your career. And so, having gone through this in multiple different ways in multiple different communities, I think that I was prepared better this time around than any other previous time to know the value of getting everybody on the same page early in the process. And it just so happened that we already had a council that was on that page. So that we started out from a good spot. But then, you know, it was like you said earlier, how do you create that common language that everybody's speaking from? And so the Strong Towns approach was really kind of a great framework to have, because you could say, hey, go read the book. You know, and we did that. We went out and we bought the book and we handed it out. We put them in the library. We had Chuck do our kickoff to the actual comprehensive planning process. It was supposed to be an in-person presentation. It ended up because of COVID being a virtual presentation, but we had overwhelming participation in that from the community. And so, just having everybody in the community on that same wavelength from the very beginning was really important. And then we just kept reinforcing that. So with the advisory committee that was made up of a cross-section of people from the community, you know, they all read the book. We had a lot of meetings with them to talk about, you know, what are these things that he's talking about in this book? What is the growth Ponzi scheme? The cost of infrastructure maintenance,
those were meetings that you did on your own, kind of independent of the consultant team.
Yeah. And then as we were doing community engagement with, the advisory committee, as well as just the community at large, we were also doing one-on-one workshops with the city council, to help them understand some of the hard decisions that they were going to be faced with as development proposals were going to come before them. Even before we got the plan adopted, we knew that we were going to have development proposals come before them that were going to be contrary to the principles that we were trying to put in place in the plan. And so I wanted the council to be prepared to have those conversations and not, you know, sort of wake up one day and say, oh my God, why are all these developers screaming at us right now? So we did a series of four work sessions with council to talk through all of the specific issues that were going to come before them as a result of adopting these policies that were being developed in the comprehensive plan. Around how to evaluate the financial performance of a new development proposal, how to put in place tools to ensure that we get housing diversity, how to ensure gentrification doesn't drive people out of their existing homes and communities. All of those things we talked through very specifically so that we could make sure that we were all still singing from the same hymnal as we moved further into the process. And I think that that alone was probably the single best use of our time, I think, was having those four workshops, because at the end, I think every single one of the council members was on the same page. And it is so helpful now that we have the ability to say, remember, we had that conversation back, you know, in March, and we talked about how, you know, that this is the tool that we need to put in place in order to achieve the goal that we've put into the plan. So I don't know. I feel really good about it. Like, the whole process ended up being really good, and I don't want to take the credit for it, because I think the whole community was just in lockstep throughout the process.
It was. I think you should take, but both of you should take some of the credit, because I think this was a comp plan done right. Where I think the main, in my mind, the biggest part of a comp plan is getting alignment of your elected officials, your planning commission, your staff, and it's having the hard conversations and figuring out what the right version of these things is for your community. That is the most important part of a comp plan to me, is the guiding principles and what is really important to the identity of your community that you want to protect. What are things that you want to add to strengthen your community? And how can land use and zoning and all of those things help you achieve those goals? And we get so, I kind of compare it to a sandwich sometimes, where in city building, we get in the middle of where we're looking at zoning cases and we're building infrastructure and we're building housing. And we don't think about the why of, like, what is the real purpose of this community that we're building? And we also don't think about the very, very kind of incremental implementation, or what are all the little things that can make quality of life in our neighborhoods better on a daily basis, that are smaller and quicker and cheaper than some of the bigger projects that we do as cities. But Mayor, could you maybe expand on that a bit? I know your council was aligned going into this, but I'm sure, as Tom just said, I'm sure there were certain folks on your council, maybe you too, that had thoughts going through this of, like, oh man, I know this developer, or I know that landowner, or I know somebody's going to come and they're going to want something, and I'm going to feel inclined to say yes. How did this process help you and your fellow council members get comfort sticking your, you know, just following through on this? And I know there's still more follow through to do with the adoption and the code, but there were, you know, there were conversations that Tom had with you and our team and the consulting team that happened that helped. But I'm just curious how those conversations with you and your peers there kind of evolved through the process, that, you know, at the end of this, you were comfortable recommending it for approval.
Yeah. Tom doesn't want to take credit, but I'm going to give Tom a lot of credit for helping the council through this. And, you know, this is all stuff that, again, sounds great when we talk about it, like, among the council, and these concepts really resonated. And it's like, yeah, this absolutely. But when the rubber meets the road, when you start getting those calls, you start getting those pressures, like, wait, you know, this isn't going to work for me as a landowner. This isn't going to work for me as a developer. We knew that was coming. And I think those workshops that Tom alluded to were very helpful in terms of kind of checking back in with the council, and gave me the opportunity to raise that issue with the council. Like, look, we're all in lockstep here, and we all are nodding our heads, and this all, you know, this all sounds good, and we're all buying in, and this is the direction we need to go as a community. And this is what, not just from a council perspective, this is what we're hearing from our residents. This is the direction that they're wanting us to go. And we're true believers in it as well. That's all well and good until you're, you know, getting a phone call or getting asked out to lunch. And, you know, this need not be a combative process. I think, you know, ultimately there's going to be conversations around the elements of the comprehensive plan and how, you know, that plays out. You know, the hard part is ahead of us. But it was imperative that we have conducted those workshops, as Tom mentioned, and as a team, really kind of forge that bond, that these are really ideas that we're behind as a group. And we know it's not going to be easy. If it was easy, everybody'd be doing this. And I do think Taylor is kind of stepping out as a leader in that respect. And we're testing some waters that I think haven't been broadly tested before. But, you know, it's a message that we got back loud and clear from the community. And it's again, in the abstract, everybody buys into it. And they have a vision for what they like Taylor to be going forward. They want to retain that community character. They want all these elements of the town to be preserved and enhanced upon. Sometimes the detail of that on how you get there is going to be, you know, more controversial than the end result, because what landowners or developers will say, hey, look, this is what we do every other place. These other communities do this. Why aren't you doing this? I mean, you're being unreasonable. You're anti-growth, anti-development. What we heard through the conference of plan process is we don't want to look and feel like all these other communities, which are faceless. They tend to kind of morph into one another. You don't know, you know, if you're in town X versus town Y, because they have not retained that character. And that was critically important to our community members. And I think they all share the goal on where we want to be. The execution is going to be the difficult part, but I think these workshops have prepared the council as best they could be prepared, as best I could be prepared for what we're about to face.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, through the process, we have that one slide that I use that basically boils it down to three options, right? You can keep doing what you're doing, but you're going to have to pay more. You can continue paying what you're paying, but you're going to have to cut, accept your reduced services, you know, poor quality of infrastructure, or you can do something different. And, you know, I think either, and that could mean you adjust your development pattern or, you know, people, I already said the paying more one. So I felt like a lot of people understand that, you know, that as well, of like when it is about trade-offs, and when you put those trade-offs very clearly in front of people, most folks will take, hey, give us an affordable balance, right? And if that means we accept a little bit more density in this place, that's great. So it becomes it's not a conversation about yes or no for density or some of those. It's more about where do we put it and the quality of design, which is a very different conversation than should we have it or should we not. You know, and that's where the code and some of that, you know, does come into play. Tom, I know I want to talk about adoption and next steps here in a second, but I know you have been tinkering with your own little fiscal analysis tool through this process and, you know, built it, and you and the guys over at Fate and I mean, we've all shared different notes and combinations of some of these, and that's actually building those types of tools is something that that we've in the last year or so started to do a lot more of, because that's like another step. It's like, give us the code and then give us these tools that can allow our staff to do these quick kind of fiscal analyses on different kinds of development. Two-part question for you. What, you know, can you talk through one or two examples of where you have used that tool that you're building and how you've used that with conversations with the developer and or council? Let's start there, and then I'll ask my second question.
Yes, that's a great question, Kevin. I mean, I built that tool, one, so that I could understand the concept better. You know, I really wanted to know myself, how do you figure out what is a sustainable land use pattern from a financial standpoint? And, you know, what are the inputs? What are the specifics to the place that we're in as a community? And it is very specific to your particular city's financial position. You know, it's about what is your tax rate? You know, what are your engineering design standards for your streets and infrastructure? You know, how much do you allocate towards street maintenance and utility maintenance in your budget? So I built that around all of those criteria so that I could look at a new neighborhood that was being proposed and figure out, does this pencil out long term for the community? And in every instance that I've run it, it doesn't.
That's the unfortunate downside of doing these models. Yep.
Yeah, but you know, it's like one of the, I don't know what the right saying is, but you know, once you know something like that, you can't unknow it, you know? And so it, you can't be a good steward of your community's resources if you go down a path that you know is going to end in, you know, fiscal calamity at the end of the day. And so I think that that process, just for my own personal benefit, was good because I could put the numbers in the spreadsheet and run the scenarios and tweak it to make sure that I wasn't doing something wrong in the equation. I asked you for help, you know, to look at it. Am I doing something that is stupid here? And then I used it in one of those workshops that the mayor was and I were talking about to show the council that we had a couple of proposed developments that were coming in. And I was able to plug the information from those developers' proposals into the tool and clearly show that they would result in a shortfall of revenue for the city to be able to, you know, maintain the streets and infrastructure in that new neighborhood. So from that standpoint, it was, I think, a good use of the knowledge that we had gained through the process and then a practical application of it to say, okay, we understand that some types of development patterns are more financially resilient than others. How do we evaluate one? And now we can do that. Now, you know, granted it's a rudimentary tool so far, but I think that, as you mentioned, part of the implementation of the plan is to put in place these tools to help us as we grow, understand if we're making good decisions or not. And, you know, we talk in the plan about having a growth dashboard so that we can actually see where are we trending on these different metrics that we've identified as important to us as a community. And, you know, I do think that the one thing I've learned.
Can I cut in there? So that was a lot of fun. And the last workshop where we broke folks out and we were talking about implementation strategies, the table that I was at, the ones that went right to the top of the list were do fiscal impact analysis on new development, build us a dashboard so the community can, so the city leaders can communicate progress towards closing our gap, make our streets kind of, you know, look at our street design, basically make the streets safer and make them more where they're structured for more walkable neighborhoods. I mean, there were three or four or five that were on the top of the list at my table that in a lot of comp plans in the past aren't even on they're not even mentioned. You know, and that was so cool to see that at the end of this process, you have the community saying these are priorities for us because they saw the connection of how those tools would help you guys make better decisions, but also I think how they as residents could kind of see the progress, right? I mean, that's something that we just had a call with our team the other day that we see with a lot of these projects that we're doing right now, just we talk about the resource gap, but there's also a growing engagement gap between the residents and their city of like, and it's different reasons. Some they're not engaged because they're frustrated. Some they're not engaged because they're just apathetic or whatever. But at the end of the day, the residents do, they want to know what decisions are being made and why they're being made, and do it in a language that they understand. And this process and this dashboard, I think, has just really set you guys up for how a connected, like an integrated process of long range kind of high level planning that council needs to do with the day-to-day decisions that staff makes, whether it's a zoning case or an infrastructure capital improvement project, with what the residents are hearing of like, here's why we're doing these, here's where we're spending your money, and here's how it's making us more, you know, financially sustainable and also getting you better value on your taxpayer dollars. That I walked out of that last workshop and that's what was in my head. I never had a chance to tell you guys that, but you guys, the process worked in my opinion. So what about you just mentioned you got a meeting in 2 days to adopt the plan. Talk a little bit about the adoption process. Have there been folks that have come in and been strongly opposed to it? And how have you navigated those discussions? Or has it been, you've already done most of the engagement and it's been a pretty easy adoption process? Mayor, let's start with you.
Well, again, this goes to the abstract versus the very concrete. In terms of the comprehensive plan and the elements behind it, the philosophy of the comprehensive plan, no pushback. People get it. They understand it. They like it. But when it's directly applied, sometimes you can have issues. In fact, you know, we have a new development that's going in Taylor that is incorporating a lot of the principles of that are embodied in our comprehensive plan. It's mixed use development with kind of small neighborhood commercial, some multifamily, some single family, a nice mix, really kind of subscribing to a lot of the elements of the plan, which again, in the abstract, everybody loves it when it's adjacent to your neighborhood and that's not what you're used to, then maybe you're not as enthusiastic about it. And that's to be expected. I think that's just human nature, but you know, we're getting early examples of that tension and that conflict. But in terms of the adoption of the plan and the philosophy, the direction it represents, it's been almost universally supported by everyone who I've engaged with on this. But Tom, you may be hearing some different things.
No, I think that by and large, the community, if you're just asking a average citizen in the community whether this plan is the right plan for Taylor, I think they would say yes, because it is about what's going to make us a strong community financially, and our neighborhoods are going to be better for this plan. But if you talk to others who don't have that long-term interest in the community, whether it be a property owner that's made an investment in a piece of property that they wanted to be able to sell for development in the future, or it's a developer who wants to actually develop a piece of property that they have purchased, we did get some pushback during the process from those folks, and some of the commercial real estate agents as well, who whose livelihood is made up of selling some of those properties. So they did say, but the cool thing about the conversations that we had with those folks was they didn't disagree with the fundamentals of what we were saying. You know, they didn't disagree with the analysis or the math that we were doing that showed why these things were not sustainable long term. But they just said, but, you know, these people have a right to do something with their property. And so that's where, especially in Texas, you know, which is a very strong property rights state, it becomes complicated to have those conversations with folks. And I think that the important thing there is to just be very honest about what is the responsibility of the municipal government and what are our interests versus what are your interests. And there's nothing wrong with either side. You know, you've got a personal financial interest that you're looking out for, and the city has a long-term financial interest for the community that it's looking out for. And sometimes those two things just aren't going to align. And, you know, it doesn't mean anybody's bad. It just means that, you know, sometimes there's going to just have to be those difficult conversations. And we have had some of those, and I think we'll continue to have more of them, obviously, as the community grows. Sure. And, you know, I don't know where we'll end up. I'm very curious, like, what is it? What is the compromise that will be struck, you know, in the future? And where will we end up as a community? I think that's yet to be seen.
It's just shifting the discussion back a little bit to where I feel like it was headed down this path of yeah, I have the right to, it's not just I have the right to develop my property, but it's, oh, by the way, U City should punch the infrastructure out here for me, and U City should give me an incentive to help me with these upfront costs. And, you know, U City are already on the hook to maintain everything after the fact. And it was so, the discussion was so one-sided towards development, which I think is part of why Texas has had so much the development that we've had but now it's giving, you know, this process and these tools and this language give cities the ability to, like we talked about, or like you mentioned, Mayor, to go back to developers and say, and I think Justin and Michael at Fate have used this language of like, okay, Mr. Developer, would you accept this deal? You know, would you accept this business deal? And they're like, well, no, I wouldn't. So it does, it's that uncomfortable tension, but they do seem to get it. And then I think what'll be interesting is how do those conversations start to evolve as new deals are put together, as a city decides where you punch infrastructure out or what an economic development incentive looks like or what a housing incentive looks like. There's more tools to inform that protects your interests, and the taxpayers' interest and the long-term residents and financial health of a community than we've ever had, before. And it just needs to be, I hope that opens the door to just some stronger partnerships. You're still going to take advantage of the private side. That's the beauty of the model that we have here. But I know there's people, and that is, it's interesting you mentioned that, Tom, because that group of people that's in a community for the short term, and they're like, well, as soon as my kids are gone, I'm out of here moving somewhere else. Or that's the group of people I have not figured out how to connect with yet, because they can look at it all and they're like, well, all I want is the best quality of life today for the lowest tax rate for the next 3 or 4 years. And then it's somebody else's responsibility. Or mayor, for you on the council side, I've talked with elected officials that feel that way of like, hey, I hear what you're saying, but I'm on for another 2 or 3 years. I want to ride that lower the tax rate train, say I did good things, get a couple of ribbon cuttings and I'm out. So that's the next part, is how do we hit kind of the heart, as I say, of challenge these guys philosophically and just say, is this the right thing for the next generation? Is this the right thing for your kids or your grandkids? I've said that in so many talks that I've given, that's what drives me, is I look around today and I think the world that my kiddos are coming up in, it has been a place where if one community starts to struggle, there's another, 25 out there that somebody can move to and have a great life. I think in the next 2 decades, that's going to completely flip. And so you're going to see very, fewer and fewer communities that really do still provide a high quality of life at different price points. And it's something that, from a marketing standpoint for communities like Taylor, I think your commitment to this approach is something that can be a really strong recruiting and retention tool for your residents and businesses, saying, look, we're here for the long haul and we have tools to help us manage that. And you might lose some people in the short term that don't want to come there or don't want to stay there, but over the long haul, you're going to be a stronger community because of it.
Well, I want to say on the flip side of that, concern or the comment about a council member saying, like, I'm only here for a few years and I'm off, so I don't need to worry about it. And we talked a lot about the buy-in from the current council here in Taylor into this this approach that's embodied in the comprehensive plan. This whole exercise will be a failure if it dies with the current council. I mean, we cannot be an election cycle away from this being jettisoned. So that's why I think this process, this public process over the last year and a half or so, has been so important to increase the fluency and the vocabulary of our community members with respect to fiscal sustainability and everything that the comprehensive plan entails, because this needs to be kind of baked in to the DNA of our community going forward. And it's incumbent upon everyone who's been involved in this process, from the council down to our advisory board members and anyone else who's kind of come in contact through this process, to be kind of advocates and evangelists really for this gospel of fiscal sustainability. Because the more you talk to people about it and the more people learn about it, again, it just makes sense. And it can't be, once I or any of the other council members, once we roll off and then are replaced by a new set of council members who say, you know what, forget that, we're changing direction, that's not the course. We've heard from the community that these principles are important to them. This is the path they want to pursue. And as a community, we need to be committed to that. And again, I bear some responsibilities as a leadership within the city to help kind of spread the message and disseminate mm-hmm. that, because I think it is a winning formula for Taylor.
So a couple more, one more question, and then I'm going to get to kind of a lessons learned question for you guys, and then we'll wrap up. So we're talking all about infill and missing middle housing and focusing on, you know, building a more compact Taylor. You guys are in the process of having conversations with Samsung about a new facility there in Taylor. It's kind of out there. It's been publicized that they've selected Taylor or are close to selecting you guys. There are some things with that development that, you know, right as we're wrapping up the comprehensive plan, those discussions really started to heat up, at least publicly. How do you guys plan to incorporate that development, if it does come through, into Taylor and still hold true to the principles that are in the plan and the growth management plan that we've talked to?
Well, should Samsung select Taylor for what's being billed as, you know, the largest economic development project in the country and the largest foreign investment in U.S. history, I think, you know, $17 billion is the number that has been debated about. It, you know, certainly would be an economic dynamo, you know, and it's transformative in its impact on any community, especially Taylor and Williamson County and beyond. You know, as we mentioned, we're already having growth pressures from Austin. It was already such a hot market that we were already getting these challenges that come along with that. Now, this will be growth pressures on steroids.
Tom's like, yep.
And, you know, the real challenge is going to be, I mean, it could be a tremendous positive for the community. And, but we could also get steamrolled. And so the challenge is going to be able to do what we can to harness and direct this energy that would be created from a project on this scale, to make sure that it is, again, harnessed and directed in a way that will serve the goals of this of our community that is represented through the comprehensive plan. So, you know, it certainly is not going to be easy. It's a good problem to have in that, you know, we're going to be in a much different position if this happens. Even if it doesn't, I mean, we still have this economic vibrancy from the Austin metro area that's pressing on here. But we're in a much different place than we were in the latter half of the 20th century in terms of the economic vitality and vibrancy that is represented in this region and in Taylor specifically. But it's Samsung, should they come to Taylor, that could really be a force for a lot of positive change throughout the community and could really serve what we're trying to accomplish through the comprehensive plan. Again, there's going to be a lot of challenges from forces outside that I talked about. We were almost begging and pleading people to come out to look at Taylor to consider for development a few years ago. Yeah, those days will be over at that point, and it's going to be making sure that we have growth and development that really serves the interests of our community long term. And, you know, we're talking for, there's a lot of folks who are looking for the, you know, the quick buck and the turnaround to make their money off Taylor and be on their way. But, you know, we talk about just generational impact and what this is going to do in, you know, 100 years and beyond. So, hey, I'm keeping my fingers crossed and excited about the opportunity should we be selected for this. And if there's going to be a challenge, I welcome a challenge like this. But Tom's got to do the hard work, so I'll let him speak.
Well, I mean, I think that what I've told everybody is, you know, Samsung or no Samsung, you know, the principles that we want to go forward with in terms of development patterns aren't going to change. Now, Samsung might accelerate the pace of
there you go.
Development that happens in our community. So instead of us doubling in population in 20 years, maybe we'll double in population in 10 years. But it doesn't mean we should make different decisions from a land use standpoint in terms of how we grow. The other thing is, I think that it can be a huge positive to Taylor, kind of like the railroads and cotton were in the 19th century that created this economic engine that really helped the community solve a lot of problems that it had and build wealth. I think this could be that as well. And, you know, instead of everybody having to get in their car and Taylor and drive to Austin for employment, we can have a lot of employment that happens right here in our town, which I think makes for a healthier, happier population as well. So I think it has the potential to be a big positive. But even if it doesn't happen, I think that, you know, Taylor's on the radar and we are going to grow, and hopefully we're going to grow in the right way.
Well, I think you just nailed it, Tom. I think the pattern is there. You know, we did a little bit of the population, like land use capacity analysis, and there's plenty of room in your footprint for more people. And so I think if you stay true to the principles and the footprint, and, you know, if you, and you fill in, you diversify, you know, some of that housing, and then you incrementally expand out as you need to, I think this is an absolute opportunity for you all to close your resource gap faster. I mean, so it's a huge opportunity. And I wonder, did they say, or do you think some of the characteristics and traits of Taylor and the fact that you were different than so many of the surrounding communities, do you think that played a role in Samsung's decision to consider you as one of the finalists? I know they have a lot of criteria that they're looking at, but I wonder of, like, as more and more of the workforce is looking for walkable neighborhoods and the cool downtowns, you know, you guys check those boxes, but you still have the opportunity to build more of it. So I do wonder if that was part of it, of being able to really provide that diversity of housing, the quality of life, you know, at a truly, you know, affordable price point versus your neighbors there in Austin.
I'll just say, I'd like to think so, that was one of the factors taken into consideration.
Yep. So last question for you guys. We're trying to, as we do these newer episodes and interviews, we are trying to feature more of our clients and more of our work, and but really want to wrap up with lessons learned. So what, I'll take you guys one at a time. What are maybe, what are one or two lessons, Tom, let's start with you, that you learned through this process, either the comp plan specifically, or just in terms of you diving into some of the fiscal analysis and building your tool? What are one or two lessons that you've learned from this that you'd want to share with others in your seat?
Well, I think one that I learned, or at least it was reinforced through this, is that the way that cities account for their liabilities is broken. And that until we fix that, I don't know that there's a compelling enough story out there to make a lot of communities turn the page in terms of their development patterns. When you start running the numbers, and we just, you know, we're guilty of it even to this day in our community, when we're making decisions about where to spend our money, we're not doing the math on the return on that investment. And, you know, and so we're now able to, because of this process, to identify where is a good investment, what is a good investment of our resources, our limited resources. So the lesson that I learned is that we've got to really change the way cities account for their long-term maintenance liabilities. We can't keep hiding it in our financial statements, which is what
you mean, showing streets as depreciating assets.
Exactly. I mean, it's crazy to me that is the position that every community in the country is in, is that you're showing something that's absolutely a liability as an asset and not having to account for its long-term maintenance. And so that's the biggest one to me. You know, on a more trivial line, it's harder to do a comp plan during a global pandemic than not.
From our side. The in-person stuff is critical. What about you, Mayor? Any big takeaway or lesson learned?
My takeaway would be don't wait 16 years to refresh your comp plan. That'd be the first one. Although I'd say I think we undertook this. We probably could have gotten a little earlier start than we did, but I do like the way it all kind of came together at this very critical point for this community, that I think we have the right plan at the right time, and we have the right folks involved to help us with it. So I'm pleased in that respect. Also, I mentioned that I had not been very well versed in our old comprehensive plan, but looking back at that document, it's Tom, is it like 500 to 600 pages? It's very dry, very, very difficult to really kind of follow. I was really pleased with what we came out with through this process. It is, I mean, it's based on, you know, just like five essential big ideas that kind of drive the thing with underpinning of fiscal sustainability. But we have these big ideas that kind of drive the policy decisions. And it's a very approachable, digestible document that's easy to follow and easy to understand. I'm really, really proud in that respect, because I think anyone can pick this up and get a very good idea very quickly about where Taylor is and where, and more importantly, where it's going under the framework of this comp plan.
Well, I think that's a good place to wrap us up. Mayor Brant Rydell, Tom Yantis from the city of Taylor, it's been a pleasure to work with you guys the last year plus on the plan. I'm excited to see where it goes forward, and we'll definitely have you guys back probably 6 months or so from now, and see how some of those development decisions are going.
See how bad our war wounds are.
Yeah, there you go. But appreciate you guys being on. Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin. Thank
you. Okay, so there you go. That was a long conversation, AJ. I think it went over an hour, but I know Tom and Brant are at this point. We can say the plan has officially been adopted. I think some other news that just broke here recently, right before we recorded this, is that they have been announced by Samsung as a location that Samsung's going to build a new manufacturing plant. And so that was something that towards the end, really in the adoption process, was already impact. When we talk about implementation, they're already talking about, well, how do we need to amend the plan to, to accommodate something as significant as a Samsung plant. But I don't want to come back and ask you about that. But what were a couple of takeaways that you had, AJ, as you listened to that interview, having worked on the plan a little bit, and you know, knowing Tom and the folks there in Taylor, what were a few things that you heard that you maybe you want to elaborate on?
Well, I think one is, if you're in their shoes and you're hiring consultants to help you with a comprehensive planning process, I think they underscored this in the beginning of the interview. And I think it's really, obviously it benefits us to say this, but I really do think it's good advice for people that are in planning departments around the country. If you're hiring consultants, you know, for their experience in producing documents and having a list of awards that they've arguably nominated themselves for, you know, that's not going to get you the same kind of product as identifying someone in the field whose philosophy matches your own, and they demonstrate that they can produce something that is usable, that is approachable to the community. Those things are really critical. So I think where a lot of people misstep is they go and they put together their RFQ or their RFP. They heavily skew it towards years of experience when allocating points, and they don't focus enough on some of the philosophical things that are really important in that setting. And so they end up finding a match, but the match is, you know, essentially the group that looks the best on paper. When you know, you would advise anyone when they are, you know, dating, perhaps. You know, you're looking for someone that matches you, right? That you see things the same way or a similar way. You have shared values. I'd argue it's the same kind of thing when you're trying to find a consultant. So I think Taylor set a good example for other cities in going into this with a clear philosophical stance on what was important and how they wanted to get there. And they then found people that had that same approach to doing things. And that's why I think that marriage worked so well. I think another thing that I would kind of take away from that conversation, you know, they talked a little bit about thinking through the process of how are we going to execute this at our level once this is in place. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's another really good piece of advice is, you know, there's that phrase about begin with the end in mind. And I think that applies here in a different way than most people generally apply it, which is as we're going through putting this document together, this plan for the future, is it something that our staff can understand? Do they have the tools to execute this implementation? Do we have the regulatory framework? Is that in place to really make some of these land use decisions happen? And that's something that I think Taylor put a lot of thought into. And they mentioned towards the end of the episode that they're now going to go right into a code update. And this is going to definitely inform the other types of planning processes that they're going to take on after that code update is finished. So I think that's another second piece of advice that I was really glad that they touched on and that I think people should take away.
Yeah, and that's something, you know, working through it, AJ, you know, early on, I mean, even the selection process, and we touched on it in the interview, and you just did too, of they asked some specific questions about our approach to the land use fiscal analysis and mm-hmm. how we use that information to not just inform the plan, but they asked several questions about how we would use it in a public setting to inform the public. They're, you know, Tom and the folks at Taylor are a pretty savvy group in terms of understanding some of the principles that we talk about here. And they were aware of the resource gap that they had in terms of catching up with aging infrastructure. And so that I think allowed us to really shine in the interview, honestly, to be able to talk about the specific things that we do to present some of that information. But then as we got into the project, there was some education up front about the fiscal analysis and helping the community. That was really fun for me personally to see how the community responded to those numbers and how it ultimately, you know, changed the opinions of some different folks on what they thought they wanted for their community. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so there was some education, I guess, up front, but really the meat of the plan, of the planning process, the conversations had a lot to do with implementation of, well, what are we going to do when this kind of developer or this kind of developer comes in and wants to build this? Or what are we going to do if we want to narrow our streets? So the conversation about implementation was happening 8 months ago, before this plan was even adopted. And it was always being connected back to, look, we want to be a fiscally, financially resilient place, and we want to be affordable for, you know, for different groups and, you know, for over time. And so those kept coming back. Those same kind of principles kept coming back throughout the entire process. And now that they are, you know, they got to adoption, you mentioned they're going into the code. But there's also several other tools that were being talked about as implementation that the community actually started to ask about. They asked about a dashboard of how are you going to show that we're making progress on closing our resource gap? How are you going to show that these development decisions that you're making are in the best fiscal interest of the city? Or if they're not, you know, why are we going against that? And so we talk about that common language and that community dialogue and that trust. And I didn't really get into that as much in the interview as I think I would have liked to. But I think if you would ask Tom and Brant, they would say that level of trust and dialogue in the community about some of these important issues has elevated because of this process as well.
Yeah. Not only that, you know, there's a point in the interview where Tom mentions they were having a lot of conversations with people in the community, not only at a large level, kind of in mass at these scheduled events, but also in small groups and even one-on-one. And even some of the people that they spoke to that didn't really agree with some of the decisions that are in the plan, they did understand why those decisions were being made, and they at least could accept that there was a rationale behind it. And I think that's where a lot of people get frustrated in communities as citizens, is not really seeing a rhyme or reason behind the direction forward on a particular item or even in general. And so I think that's where that common language is also really helpful, is helping translate that. So, you know, even where we have to agree to disagree sometimes as individuals with different viewpoints, we at least can understand that there's a rationale that has been universally accepted and adopted, and that's what's guiding the path forward. And I think that that's another piece of advice that communities can really learn from. I think this is a good example of going through a comprehensive planning process, not for the document at the end of it, but right. really... Yeah, for the direction, this direction that's universally accepted anyway, and people can communicate it very easily to one another. Their direction and their philosophy is something that can be summed up in a very short one or two sentences. And I think you'd be hard pressed to do that in a lot of communities. So I think that's another area where Taylor is going to see a different approach by the community as a whole, as they start guiding the group forward through this exercise of implementation.
Mm-hmm. There's a great video that that Taylor put together to promote the comp plan that we'll link up to this, but it's about 5 minutes long. That's got several members of the advisory committee that talk about their take on the plan and why it's important to them. And you'll hear, if you watch it, you'll hear several of them talk about, you know, specifics of the fiscal health or what this means for building wealth in the community or what this means for providing housing for everyone. They've got five big ideas in the plan, but they had one of the advisory committee members each take one of those five big ideas and talk about it in their own language of what it meant to them, which was a really cool take. The last thing, and we'll wrap up here, but it is the news about the Samsung plant coming. And we got, I got a few questions even before it was adopted. And as people were hearing about it being adopted and the Samsung news was kind of going around of, well, what does this mean? What does this mean for this plan, where the main focus of the plan is to grow in, is to prioritize infill? What does this mean, you know, now that you have this huge plant and all these jobs and all these additional people that are going to move to the city? And I thought Tom has handled that question well in saying that it's not going to change their development pattern. All it's going to do is accelerate the rate that they, you know, how fast they develop. So they don't really see it changing their pattern of development too much. They just see it, instead of them adding 20,000 people in 20 years or whatever it was, I don't remember the exact numbers, but they're going to add more people a lot faster, but they're still going to stay true to the principles of where they add them, the kind of development that they build. And if they do need to build new development to accommodate some of that additional population or commercial demand, it's going to stay true to the principles mm-hmm. and the form of the plan. I did ask them in the interview, and I can't remember if it was in the interview or after we stopped recording. I think it was after we stopped recording. I asked them if the comp plan and some of the discussions about the community's values and what makes Taylor unique, if that played into Samsung's decision to come there. And Brant, they couldn't say for sure. They didn't know. They couldn't say something where Samsung specifically mentioned it. But I do think that, you know, Taylor's uniqueness, the way they are, pretty different from the other communities around them there in Central Texas. I'd like to think that played some role in Samsung picking there. But I think the exciting thing going forward, as they do implementation and as they get the Samsung facility in there and see some of this growth, I actually I really do think they're going to stay true to it with implementation. And I think they have set that foundation with the language and in the community and with developers and landowners of what they want to do. And you mentioned the code. They've got the code, the dashboard, some other tools that they're putting in place as soon as they can to help them with implementation. So it's one of the first ones in Texas, especially that I think they're going to be able to say, you know, we're working towards being financially resilient and strong. And, you know, as we go through some changes in Texas with affordability and some of those things, I know we're going to see in some communities. I think places like Taylor that really have a strong plan that communicates that they're aware of their situation and that they're doing things to intentionally provide more value for their taxpayers and more, address affordability head on. I think that's going to just become more and more of an asset to their community going forward.
I think so. And I think the difference there is they also have strong leadership in place. You know, you can have the best high quality, top notch, comprehensive plan that anyone has ever seen and get it adopted in your community. But if you don't have strong leadership, that plan will not move forward. And so they have been very vocal about it. They've been having those conversations behind the scenes. They've been talking about the hows since the very beginning, which is really critical. And so that level of leadership is really required and necessary to have that strong identity and maintain that for a long period of time. I mean, arguably, the future land use map that we did for them, I think is really going to be a powerful tool because it doesn't just look at what is, which so many future land use maps stop at the step of basically using categories to preserve what's there and then trying to fill in the gaps. And this wasn't that. This was a reimagining of the entire community, giving respect to what's there, but also understanding how it could be augmented to make that city perform better. And so having that strong leadership is going to keep, I think, that future land use map from going the way of so many, which in a year or 18 months are already out of date. They lose the level of authority that they really should have. They lose that connection to the future of the community, and then they become largely ignored. So I really think it's going to be a different outcome for them.
Yeah. So just to kind of summarize here, definitely being clear up front with your RFQs, with your requests for qualifications of what are your kind of philosophical values in the community? What are you trying to achieve? And then being specific about what you want from your consultant to deliver that. That's really important. And that I think any consulting firm will tell you that allows us to do our job better. If we know clearly kind of what kind of community we're getting into and, you know, where you stand on certain principles and values. So be clear with that up front. When you get into the process itself, I can't overemphasize enough the value that the fiscal analysis and those conversations have in educating the community, aligning your leadership and different parts of your community around these kind of changes, whatever those changes may be. At least you have the resource information and the financial information to inform those discussions. And then, you know, as soon as you can on the implementation side, you know, bringing those implementation conversations forward and talking about specific examples of how you will implement the plan and some of the cases or the projects or the areas that you know are going to come up, you know, bring those up in the process and talk about them early. And I think the more of those harder conversations you have in the planning process, the more successful you're going to be when it comes to implementation. And in some ways you get to where people are excited that they want to accelerate implementation because the harder conversations have been had. So, I really enjoyed doing this episode. I enjoyed working with the Taylor folks. I hope we get to continue to work with them on the implementation, going forward, but we talk about comprehensive plans and they can be, I think they can be of tremendous value to your community if you do them in a different way and really make them about aligning your community and using the financial, information to help do that. So if you've got questions for us about this episode, if you'd like to learn more about the Taylor Project, we'll definitely link, we'll link it up in the show notes. It's posted on their website, on the website now. We'll probably, I did mention to them after the interview, wanting to have them back in 6 months or so, just as a follow-up to see how the initial implementation is going. So let us know if you have any feedback, any questions on this episode. Send them to podcast@verdunity.com, and Marshall and the rest of our team will take a look at those. And then I think what we're planning to do, AJ, is every so often as we get questions in, we'll take a little bit of time either as a separate episode or as one of our intro outro parts to tackle some of those questions that we that we get. So appreciate you listening to this one. I know it was a long episode, but next up, our next episode is going to be a conversation with the folks from Pasadena, Texas. They're another client that we've been working with for a few years now. Have some good stories to tell, both on the fiscal analysis, on a strategic plan process that we just helped them wrap up, and also on some implementation projects that we're helping them with. So I'm excited to share that interview. And we may have one kind of interim episode, I guess, between now and the end of the year that we talk about a couple of things with some of our other Verdunity team members as well. So AJ, it was good to do another one of these, get back with you, talk about something that we're passionate about and doing a lot of work on. So with that, we'll wrap this one up. We'll see you next time on Go Cultivate. Take care, guys.